Account of Montcalm's Simple Passing. 7 times had the Egyptian year carried Joseph with it in its round. 84 times the planet that he loved, to which he was kin, had gone through all its phases. Of the material substance of Jacob's son, that in which he was clothed when the father blessed him and sent him from him, nothing at all was left. He wore, so to speak, a new earthly garment, wherein God had arrayed his life. Of the old, of that worn by the 17-year-old youth, was not one thread remaining. For he walked in one woven of Egyptian stuff, in which Jacob would only doubtingly have known him. The son would have had to reassure him, saying, "It is I, Joseph." 7 years had passed in sleeping and waking, in thinking and feeling, in doing and being done by, passed as days pass, that is, neither fast nor slowly, but simply passing. And in his age he was now 24, a young man, very beautiful in form and feature, son of a lovely one, a child of love. His bearing, by reason of his activities, had become more serious and assured. His voice, the one-time childish pipe, had grown more resonant as he moved among the workmen giving directions, or, as Montcalm's mouth, transmitted all his orders. For Montcalm's mouth he had been now all these years. Or one might have called him his eye, his ear, or his right hand. The workpeople, however, spoke of him simply as the steward's mouth, for so in Egypt they called a man through whom orders are transmitted. In Joseph's case, the word was doubly apt, for the youth spoke like a god, a gift most pleasing, yes, a laughing delight to Egypt's children, and they knew that it was by that gift of shrewd and comely speech, such as was beyond their own powers, that he had made his way, or at least opened his way, to the favor of the master and Montcalm. Montcalm by now trusted him in everything, administration, accounts, oversight, and business. When the tradition states that Potiphar put all that he had into his hand, and knew not aught he had save the bread that he did eat, it refers in the last analysis to a delegation of power from the master to the steward, and from the steward to the purchased slave, with whom he had made a pact in love and loyalty to their lord. And the master and his house might be glad that it was Joseph and no other on whom the delegation finally fell, and who in the end took over the economy of the house, for he oversaw it with the utmost of loyalty and ability, for the sake of the Lord and his far-flung plan, thinking day and night on the advantage of the house, so that in the words of the old Ishmaelite and consonant with the name he had chosen, he not only provided, but also increased it. As for the reason why Montcalm, toward the end of this period of 7 years, had entrusted Joseph more and more with the oversight of affairs, until he finally gave them all into his hands and withdrew into the private room of trust, of that anon, and only a little farther on. For first, I must say that Dudu, despite all his malicious striving, did not succeed in barring the way to Joseph's happy advance, which finally, and before the 7 years were out, had set him over all the other servants, even above the rank and dignity of Potiphar's undersized keeper of the jewel caskets. Dudu's office was indeed a dignified one, and he owed it certainly to his sterling quality, his honesty and dwarf worthiness. It brought him into close contact with the master, and would have afforded occasion for confidence and the exercise of influence against Joseph, but that Potiphar could not abide the little man, whose pompous dignity went against him. He did not feel justified in taking away his office, but he kept him as removed as possible, setting subordinates between them for the service of the robing rooms, so that to Dudu fell only the care of the garments, jewels, amulets, and orders. He saw the dwarf only for brief conferences. Thus, Dudu could not easily come to speech with Potiphar, certainly not to that speech which he would gladly have made with reference to the favorite and the offense of his growing favor in the house. Even though he had had the chance, he would not have dared to speak, at least not before the master himself. For he well knew Potiphar's dislike for him, the serious-minded dwarf. It rested on the concealed sense of superiority, which he neither could nor would deny, as well as on his partisanship for Amun's sun power. He knew that his word availed little before Potiphar. Why should he, Dudu, spouse of Jesset, expose himself to a rebuff? No, he preferred a roundabout way. He would act through the mistress, to her he often complained, and at least she listened with respect, and through Becnekons, the mighty man of Ammon. He, when he visited the mistress, could be warned against the advancement of the Shabarite, so offensive to ancient traditions. And he instigated Jesset, his full-sized wife, who was in Mutim Enet's service, to talk to her mistress in the same sense. But even industry will not always bring success. If Jesset had not been fruitful to her spouse, it would have been a case in point. Here, at least, his striving bore no fruit. It is true that one day Becnekons, in Pharaoh's antechamber, took Petipre to task, diplomatically, for the annoyance suffered by the pious of his household through the advancement of the impious there, and expostulated with him in fatherly wise. But the fan-bearer did not take it in. He could not remember. He blinked and seemed absent. And Becnekons, owing to his flair for greatness, was incapable of pausing for more than a minute upon small domestic details. He soon passed over into more exalted spheres and harangued the four quarters of the heavens as he held forth upon problems of state, speaking of the foreign kings Tushratta, Shubilulima, and Apt Ashirta, and upon these high themes the conversation expended itself and died. As for Mut, the mistress, she had not brought herself as yet to speak to her husband on the subject. She knew his unhearing obstinacy. Moreover, she was not used to talking over matters with him, their intercourse consisting altogether of tender and exaggerated expressions of concern. It did not occur to her to make any demands upon him. These were sufficient grounds of excuse for her inaction. But in our eyes, it is also a sign that even at that time, that is to say, toward the end of the 7 years, she was indifferent to Joseph's presence, and had no motive for wishing to have him sent away. The time when she would want him removed from her sight and hearing was still to come for this woman of Egypt. It came at the same time with that fear of herself, which yet she was too proud to know. And another strange something would come to pass at the same time, the time when she realized that it would be better for her to see Joseph no more and turn to Petipre to get him sent away. It was that Dudu had been converted to the Shabarite and become his partisan, for he began to flatter him and be obsequious to him to such an extent that a change of roles seemed to have taken place between the dwarf and his mistress. The latter appeared to have assumed the former's hatred, and the dwarf to praise and belaud the youth in her hearing. Both attitudes were entirely specious, for at the moment when the mistress would have wished that Joseph was not there, she could no longer do so, and deluded herself in thinking that she did. But Dudu, who had quite a glimmering of it, acted in malice, hoping the more to injure the son of Jacob by being comradely with him. But I shall speak of this a little later, for the event which brought about these changes, or upon which they followed, was the sore illness of the steward Montcalm, Joseph's ally in the service of the master. Sore for him, sore for Joseph, who so clung to him that he almost made a matter of conscience of his sufferings and death. And distressing to all sympathizers of the simple but intuitive man, even though these might have insight into the necessity of his destined passing. For we are obliged to see the hand of destiny in the circumstance that Joseph had been brought into a house whose steward was devoted to death. And so, in a sense, his passing was sacrificial. Fortunate that he was a man whose soul inclined to resignation, a readiness which in another place I have attributed to his trouble with his kidneys. But it is quite possible that the latter was only the physical constitution corresponding to his spiritual state, actually the same, distinguished from it only as the word is distinguished from the thought, and the word sign from the word, so that in the book of the steward's life, a kidney would have been the hieroglyph for the word resignation. Why should we concern ourselves with Montcalm? Why do I speak of him with a certain emotion, though unable to say much more of him than that he was known to be a man simple, that is, modest, and upright, that is, both practical and good-hearted, a man who trod the earth of Egypt and the land of Kemah, late or early, according as one takes it, at the time when life among its manifold shapes brought just him and no other forth, but early enough in all its lateness that his mummy has long since been dust and scattered to the four winds. A practical son of earth, who did not imagine himself to be better than life, and had no use for higher or speculative matters, not out of inferiority, but out of modesty, although in his secret depths he was quite accessible to higher promptings. Indeed, it was these which made him play a role, a not inconsiderable one, in Joseph's life. Figuratively speaking, he did very much what Reuben had one day done. He retreated 3 steps before Joseph, bowed his head, and turned away. It needs no more than this role given him by destiny to make us owe him a lively sympathy. Aside from which, and for his own sake, I like to dwell upon the figure of this man, simple yet sensitive as he was, and pervaded by an unassuming melancholy. It has a sympathetic spiritual claim upon us, he would have called it magic, which makes me like to conjure it up out of its ancient dust. Montcalm was the son of an under-official of the treasury of the Montu Temple at Karnak. When he was 5 years old, his father, whose name was Akhmosa, had dedicated him to Tot, and put him into the school attached to the administration of the Temple of Montu, the falcon-headed god of war, where the rising generation of officials was brought up on short commons, strict discipline, and plenty of canings. For the view obtained that a pupil had his ears on his back, and heard when he was beaten. The pupils were of varied origins, aristocratic and middle class. Besides the discipline, they received the fundamentals of a literary education, the word of God, otherwise writing, the art of the reed, the gift of a good style, and the necessary equipment for a career of learning as well as for that of official scribe. Akhmosa's son did not want to become a scholar, not because he was not clever enough, but because he was too modest, resolved from the beginning to dwell within the sphere of the respectable average, and not at any price to depart beyond it. It happened almost against his will that he did not, like his father, spend his days as a writer of documents in the office of Montu's temple, but became overseer to one of the great. It was his superiors and masters who recommended him thither, and got him the excellent post, out of the regard they had for his gifts and his modest demeanor. At school, he received only the inevitable canings, which fell to the lot of even the best pupils, in order to make them hear. For he early gave evidence of his head for the general by the quickness with which he mastered the great gift of the ape, the art of writing. The care and neatness with which he wrote out in long lines in his roll the copy before him, consisting of ancient rules of propriety, style-forming models, didactic poems, admonitions, and praise for the writer's craft, and covered the reverse side with calculations about sacks of corn and notes for business letters. Almost from the beginning he had been set to work on the practical business of administration, more on his own initiative than that of his father, who would gladly have made of his son something better than he was himself, a priest perhaps, a magician or stargazer. Whereas from boyhood, Montcalm, in his modesty, had decided for the practical side. There is something peculiar about this sort of inborn resignation, which takes the form of honest capacity and quiet toleration of the hardships of life, where another nature would shatter the heavens with loud remonstrance. Montcalm married, rather early, the daughter of one of his father's colleagues with whom he fell in love, but his wife died in her first childbirth, and the infant with her. Montcalm lamented her loss most bitterly, without being greatly astonished or rebellious at this blow from the hand of fate. He did not try for happiness a second time, remaining a widower and solitary. He had a sister married to a bazaar keeper at Thebes. He visited her sometimes when he had a holiday, of which he never took many. After finishing his education, he worked at first in the offices of the temple administration, later became steward to the chief priest, and after that to the great household of Petipre the courtier, where he had for 10 years wielded his office with firm but good-natured authority at the time when the Ishmaelites relieved the overburdened man in his service to his beloved master by bringing him an assistant, and at the same time a successor. He had early perceived that Joseph was destined to follow after him, for he was, in all his assiduous simplicity, a man of intuition. We may almost say that the simplicity itself, The selfless resignation was a product of the same intuition. In other words, of the illness lying dormant in his powerful frame. The very working of it, silently breaking down his physical morale, but refining the spiritual, was what made possible the subtle impressions which he received at first sight of Joseph. At that time, he already knew the nature of his ailment. Redbelly, the barber surgeon, had told him plainly, diagnosing from the symptoms of frequent dull pressure in his back and left side, irregular pains in the region of the heart, frequent giddiness, sleeplessness, poor metabolism, and excessive urination, that he suffered from degeneration of the kidneys. This ailment is often insidious in its nature, strikes its roots during early life, and then has periods when it seems to be arrested or even cured, only to evince its hidden progress later on. Montcalm could remember that when he was 12 years old, he passed blood-impregnated urine, but only once, and then not again for many years, so that he had really forgotten the alarming symptom. It happened again when he was 20, together with the above-mentioned manifestations, the headache and giddiness culminating in violent nausea. That, too, passed. But since then, he had quietly and grimly wrestled with intermittent attacks, which would leave him free for months or even years to take possession of him again with greater or less violence. The modesty which was their source came out often in profound fatigue, physical and mental weariness and indifference. He made a practice of sticking to his tasks throughout, heroically and in silence, being treated by medical science, or what passed as such, with bloodletting. His appetite was satisfactory, his tongue clean, the skin excretions in good order, and his pulse fairly regular. The physician, therefore, did not consider his condition serious until one day his ankle bones displayed whitish swellings full of a watery fluid. When it was drawn off, the relief to his vascular system and his heart made one regard the symptom as favorable, because it was the disease coming out and being got rid of. He had indeed, with the help of Redbelly and his herbal treatments, got through quite tolerably the decade before Joseph's arrival, with but few interruptions to his activities, though that was very likely to be ascribed more to his own modest strength of purpose, holding in check the slow process of decay, than it was to Redbelly's homely remedies. He had his first really severe attack very soon after Joseph came, with such dropsy in hands and legs that they had to be bandaged, throbbing headache, badly upset stomach, and even a dimming of the vision. Probably it had begun during the bargaining with the Ishmaelite and the examination of his goods. At least we may surmise it, for it seems as though his sensitiveness to Joseph's looks and the emotion he showed at the test good-night greeting indicated a morbidly heightened receptivity. But the converse might also be true, that the all-too-gentle words had affected his spirit to soften it, and make it a more ready prey to the evil power assailing it. I am tempted to harbor the misgiving that Joseph's good-night addresses, however soothing to the steward, were actually unfavorable to the will to live which struggled in his depths with the fell disease. The attack was responsible, too, for the fact that Montcalm paid no attention to Joseph in the beginning. It lamed his initiative, but it passed, like others of greater or less severity, thanks to Kun Anpu's bloodlettings, leeches, arbitrary decoctions of animal or vegetable nature, and abdominal compresses made of old pieces of writing soaked in warm oil. Recovery, or apparent recovery, ensued, and reigned over large spaces of the time during which Joseph was growing up to be his first assistant and chief mouth. But in the 7th year of Joseph's time, Montcalm caught a cold at the funeral of a relative, his sister's husband, the bazaar keeper, in fact, and it opened the door wide to dissolution, which then ensued.